This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes. Also, make sure to check out and subscribe to our YouTube original channel, UCTV Prime, available only on YouTube at youtube.com/UCTV Prime. This UCTV podcast is sponsored in part by Audible.com, your destination for the widest selection of digital audiobooks available, including many by guests you've heard here on UCTV. Audible.com is offering UCTV podcast listeners a free 30-day trial subscription and one free audiobook download. Just visit audibletrial.com/UCTV to sign up. That's audibletrial.com/UCTV. And thanks.
I'm excited to introduce our talk tonight. This month's lecture is by Dr. Parsons, who will present prostate cancer screening. Dr. Parsons is an associate professor of surgery at UC San Diego Moores Cancer Center. He specializes in prostate cancer, benign prostatic hyperplasia, bladder cancer, and kidney cancer. He's an expert in robotic-assisted surgery, prostate laser surgery, and cryosurgery. Dr. Parsons was named top doctor by San Diego Magazine in 2010, 2011, and 2012, and was selected U.S. Best Doctors in 2009 and 2010. He's an internationally recognized expert in prostate disease and urologic oncology, and he has presented more than 140 scientific articles. He's edited textbooks, and he's received research grants from the National Cancer Institute. So please welcome Dr. Parsons.
Thank you so much, Danielle, for that very kind introduction. Thank you all for coming in today, and thank you all at home for visiting the website. This, I think, is my sixth year doing these lectures, and it's always very, very pleasurable for me to do these, to meet with folks, to hear your questions, and then also to hear that some of the patients who come in to see me are viewing the lectures not only by myself, but my colleagues on the internet. So really, all those hits that Danielle was talking about don't surprise me. And I think that it's great that UC continues to maintain this level of commitment to the community. I'm today going to talk about a topic that of late has become increasingly controversial, and that's prostate cancer screening. And it's a difficult topic to wrap your arms around that I'm going to do the best that I can with the time that I'm allotted, and try to give you some very practical recommendations. Bear in mind that a lot of the time when we approach a topic like prostate cancer screening, we have to take a big picture kind of view. We have to think not only about patients individually, but patients on a national level. This is a picture of San Diego from space, and what I do to put that up there is to remind me and to point out to folks in the audience that when you see things on a day-to-day basis, when you see the details on a day-to-day basis, you drive to work, you drive to restaurants, you drive to movie theaters, you live your life, you see certain things. But if you take a step back and you see a view from space, you lose some of those details, but you start to see other patterns. For example, the kinds of patterns that I see and don't typically appreciate living in San Diego are how large our harbor is right here, how big Coronado Naval Station is, how far my drive from work is. I live about here. I only have to drive here to get to work, and it always seems a little bit farther than what it really is. But on the other hand, every time I have to drive my daughter to gymnastics practice, which is out here in El Cajon, it's every bit as far as I feel like it is as I'm driving there. So in order to approach this topic, I'm going to start with basic anatomy and basic physiology of the prostate. And if you've seen my lectures before, this is something that I go over each and every time I give this lecture because I think it's very, very important. So if you've watched my lectures before, you can fast forward to the parts that come after. But first of all, what is the prostate? Well, the prostate is a male sexual gland, and it has one mission in life only, and that is to add fluid to semen during ejaculation. And this fluid essentially allows semen to survive, or sperm rather, to survive outside of the body so that they can fertilize eggs. And so when a man ejaculates, the majority of the fluid that's coming out, in fact, is coming from the prostate gland. So its entire mission in life, therefore, is devoted to reproduction. So once a man gets to be older, in fact, arguably a prostate gland does very little, and certainly does very little positively, and in fact does a lot, arguably negatively. I also like to show you these slides to give you an idea of what prostate cancer is all about. This is a microscopic picture of a normal prostate gland, and this is what every first-year medical student who comes in looks at and learns to interpret when they look at cells under a microscope. The important thing that I want you to keep in mind is just look at the general pattern here, kind of like looking at San Diego from space. Look at these nice wide open white spaces. That's normal. Look at these nice finger-like projections into the white spaces. That's normal. Look at these nice orderly rows of circular dots. Those are cellular nuclei, the center of cells. Those are all normal. This is what prostate cancer looks like, and look at that pattern. Look how different it looks. It's all jumbled together. Those nice orderly rows are gone. Those nice fingers are gone. Those nice big white spaces are gone. All of that's gone because the prostate cancer is no longer responding to the body's controls. The prostate cancer is now growing independently of what the body is trying to tell it to do. Things that cause prostate cancer. Well, there are three very important things that we have linked to the causes of prostate cancer. The first is genes. It's what you're born with. And there's no way around that. And increasingly every year, we're identifying more and more genes and genes that control genes that are involved with prostate cancer and susceptibility to prostate cancer. Because just because you have a gene that makes you susceptible to prostate cancer doesn't mean you're going to get prostate cancer. The second thing is age. As you get older, you are more likely to develop prostate cancer. So a 70 or an 80-year-old man is much more likely to develop prostate cancer than a 40-year-old man. And finally, if you're an African-American gentleman, you're more likely to be diagnosed with prostate cancer, not only diagnosed with prostate cancer, but to be diagnosed with more aggressive forms of prostate cancer. And there are a lot of folks who are trying to work out why that is, but the reasons currently remain unclear. Well, what are other things that cause prostate cancer that perhaps you have a little bit more control over other than ethnicity, age, and race? Well, a couple other things that have become clear in recent years in particular, it's how you live your life and particularly how we live our lives here in the United States. Obesity has been associated with an increased risk of aggressive forms of prostate cancer. So has consumption of a lot of red meat. And on the flip side of things, if you live a pretty healthy life, if you get a lot of exercise in particular, and by a lot, I mean even if you just exercise 30 minutes a day moderately, walking around the block, walking a few miles. You do that up to 7 days a week, but 5 days a week is just fine. You decrease your risk of prostate cancer and other cancers also, incidentally. And then also if you eat a lot of vegetables. If you eat 7 servings a day or more of vegetables, that's a goal that we have a lot of our prostate cancer patients try to achieve. A cup counts, or rather a serving counts as a half a cup to a cup. So those are things that you can take a little bit more control over that are healthy for you in general, but are specifically linked to prostate cancer itself. Moving on to important facts about prostate cancer. So I've tried to keep this broad in terms of what is important to thinking about prostate cancer and then later on talking about prostate cancer screening. The first is that it's extremely common. It's extremely common. There are some estimates that say that every man walking around in the United States over the age of 55 years of age. So every man walking around in the United States over the age of 55 years of age, 1 in 4 of those men is going to have prostate cancer. 1 in 4 of those men is going to have prostate cancer, regardless of any tests you've done or anything like that, regardless of how aggressive it is, not aggressive, that's the overall probability. And I think it's hard to go anywhere these days and be in a room with men over the age of 50 or 60 years for whom prostate cancer has not touched their lives, if not personally, certainly some of the men who they know. Secondly, it's usually detected quite early in the United States, and that's happened in recent years because of blood testing, PSA blood testing, and we'll get more to that a little bit later. And third, it has a very high cure rate compared to other kinds of cancers. It has a very high cure rate, partially because we detect it early, but partially because it's a cancer that, on the whole, is very amenable to treatment. Unlike, say, pancreas cancer. Pancreas cancer is extremely aggressive and is less amenable to definitive treatment the way that prostate cancer is. Well, I said it was common, and in fact, the lifetime risk of being diagnosed with prostate cancer if you live in the United States is currently 1 in 6. That goes for me. That goes for my son, who's 9 years old. That goes for anybody who's sitting in the audience or watching at home. 1 in 6 U.S. men are going to be diagnosed with prostate cancer at some point in their lives, and that's extraordinarily high. The number of men who were diagnosed in the United States in 2012 were 241,740. So over 240,000 men, almost 250,000 men diagnosed in the United States last year. Again, that's how common it is. And if you have to wrap your mind a little bit around what that means, this is San Diego. I always want to say San Diego Jack Murphy Stadium, but of course it's Qualcomm Stadium now. I grew up in San Diego, so that sort of still pops to my mind in the forefront. But Qualcomm holds a little over 70,000 men. So if you were to fill Qualcomm Stadium to capacity with men who are diagnosed with prostate cancer every year, you would fill Qualcomm 3.5 times over. That's a lot of men being diagnosed with prostate cancer. And this is every single year in the United States. Well, how about the number of men who died of prostate cancer in the United States in 2012? Well, thankfully, that number is lower. And in fact, there's a large discrepancy between the number of men who are diagnosed each year and the number of men who actually die of prostate cancer every year. And that number is a little over 28,000, so much less than the number of men who are diagnosed every year. Again, thankfully, it's still a horrible disease, and in fact, it's one of the top cancer killers among men in the United States. If you were to put that in perspective, this is Petco Park in San Diego, and the capacity of Petco Park is a little over 40,000, and so you can imagine that about two-thirds of Petco, so if you fill Petco Park about two-thirds to capacity, that's the number of men who are going to lose their lives to prostate cancer every single year in the United States. So this is a major problem that we're dealing with each and every year. You can tell by the discrepancy between the number of men who are diagnosed every year and the number of men who actually die every year. You can tell by that discrepancy that there are a lot of prostate cancer survivors out there. There are 2.5 million. That's what the American Cancer Society currently estimates, and that number is growing every single day because we are very effective at treating prostate cancer, at curing it, and at enabling men to move on with their lives. And so that number is likely going to continue to rise. These are some of the men who have been diagnosed with prostate cancer, who have gone on the record as having been diagnosed with prostate cancer. It's an election year, so I've covered, I think, the entire political spectrum here. I've not favored one side or the other. And all these men have approached their cancer in different ways. Some of these gentlemen have undergone surgery. Some have undergone radiation. Well, how is prostate cancer diagnosed? And this is going to tie right into the screening, the prostate cancer screening discussion. How is prostate cancer diagnosed? Well, for all of you who have ever wondered why doctors do this examination, this is your answer right here anatomically. Imagine that there's a man standing up in front of the room and he's turned sideways like this, and we've cut him in half. We've sawed him in half. So you are looking directly inside a man who's been cut in half sideways, and you're looking inside. He's standing up straight, so his head's up here and his feet are down here. And this is his bladder. This is what's called the symphysis pubis, so it's that firm bone that you can feel right in the front down there. This is the penis and the testicles. And this is the anus and the rectum. And when we do that examination, what we're doing is we're putting a finger in here, and we're feeling the prostate, the back side of the prostate right here. It's a very important examination to do because when prostate cancer grows, it tends to feel very firm. It tends to feel what we say, what doctors like to say, indurated. It feels abnormal compared to all the other things around it. Well, a reasonable question that people ask is, well, if you can feel this part of the prostate, what about this part of the prostate? You can't feel that. And the answer is that Mother Nature has helped us out there because 90% of all prostate cancers happen here in this area, where if we can feel them, that's where they're going to be. We can feel them here. So yes, there are cancers that occur here, but thankfully they don't occur quite as often. So we diagnose prostate cancer through two ways. Initially, we do what's called a prostate-specific antigen blood test. More on that, of course, later. And then we do the prostate examination, which is what I was just referring to. If either one of these two tests or examinations, or two tests, are abnormal. So if the blood test is abnormal, which means it's abnormally high, or the examination doesn't feel quite right, well then typically your urologist, your doctor is going to have a diagnosis or a discussion with you about doing a prostate biopsy. And a prostate biopsy is when you take a small needle and you place it into the prostate and you take samples of the prostate, and that's how you actually diagnose the cancer. Because after you put the needle into the prostate, you get those samples, you look at the samples under a microscope, and that's how you're able to actually see the prostate cancer. One other point that I'll make about the anatomy, look where the prostate is sitting. If you had to pick one organ in the body that was one of the most difficult to treat, because it is sitting around so many other very, very important organs, the prostate is definitely up in the top five. It's sitting right in front of the rectum. It's sitting right below the bladder. I haven't shown you, but it's sitting all below the intestines, which are right up here. It's sitting behind this bone, the symphysis pubis. It's sitting right on top of the muscle that controls urination. It's called the external urinary sphincter. It's sitting right here. And so you can see by that, because it's sitting around all of these very vital organs, there are a lot of side effects associated with treatment. Doesn't matter whether you do surgery or radiation or you get hormone treatments. Well, or surgery or radiation if you're trying to treat it. Invariably, there is some risk of having side effects because of all these organs, the bladder and the rectum and the sphincter muscle all surrounding it. In addition, there are very important nerves that aren't shown on this chart, very important nerves that run along either side of the prostate that are very important for erections and sexual health. Going back to the blood test, prostate-specific antigen, the PSA blood test. PSA, as we'll talk about a little bit in a few more slides, it is our front line for screening, for diagnosing men with the possibility that they might have prostate cancer. PSA is a good test, but it's not a great test, and this is why. PSA is abnormal. It goes up when you have prostate cancer around, but it also goes up in a lot of other situations that have absolutely nothing to do with prostate cancer. Benign prostatic hyperplasia, which is also called prostate enlargement, which is it's a abnormal growth of the prostate that is unrelated to cancer, that puts pressure on the bladder and can often give men urination symptoms. If you have infections of the bladder or of the prostate, that can make a PSA level go up. If you have any kind of prostate procedures, like a biopsy, or you have a bladder surgery, for example, that can make a PSA level go up. If you have sex, the process of ejaculation, you recall that the prostate makes most of the fluid that is in the ejaculate. That can make a PSA level go up. And finally, I didn't used to believe this, but now living in San Diego, where there are a lot of triathletes here and folks who otherwise ride their bicycle a lot, I really do think that if you ride your bicycle enough right before you have a PSA blood test done, particularly if you don't usually ride on a regular basis, that can also cause a temporary increase in your PSA. And there are some research papers that do back that up. Now, importantly, there is also one very important thing that can make a PSA level go down, and that is a particular kind of medication that men take for enlarged prostate, for benign prostatic hyperplasia, BPH, which I just mentioned. And these class of medications, they're called 5-alpha reductase inhibitors, or 5-ARIs. The important thing is that there are two of them. One's called finasteride, also called Proscar. One's called dutasteride, also called Avodart. Maybe some of the men in the audience are either on it themselves or know men that are on these medications. They're fairly common. And these medications will make PSA drop by about 50% after you're on them for about 6 months or so. They'll make the PSA levels drop 50%. Now, it's important. That doesn't necessarily change things. In fact, if a patient comes in to see me and they're on Proscar or they're on Avodart, and I know that they are, I take their PSA level that they have and I automatically multiply it by 2 and I get their real PSA. I tell you this to be cognizant of it if you're on these medications. Remind your doctor that you're on these medications if you are getting routine PSA levels. Okay, so let's move into the meat of the discussion today. We've talked a little bit about how to diagnose prostate cancer, what prostate cancer is all about, but we're really here to talk about prostate cancer screening and diagnosis and some of the controversies that surround it. Here is the dilemma. I've tried to boil the dilemma down to a couple of big points. The first is that prostate cancer is one of the most slow-growing cancers, but it happens to be the one cancer out of all of them that we can detect and treat years before you would otherwise ever know that it's there. Okay, that's the first piece of the dilemma. The second piece of the dilemma is that many men in the United States will die with prostate cancer, but not of prostate cancer. There are, for example, a lot of research studies done from autopsies of men who died of other causes. And these research studies found that high proportions of older men in the United States had prostate cancer, what we call incidental prostate cancer, in their prostates that they never knew were there, their doctors never knew were there. They died of a heart attack or a stroke or something else. They had prostate cancer, was never detected and treated, and never harmed them. But, and here's the dilemma, we can't always predict who. So you may have a prostate cancer, you may not die of it. We have pretty good methods of predicting whether or not this prostate cancer will eventually grow and spread and affect your lifespan. But we can't, in 2012, do that with 100% efficiency. We can't always predict who is going to die with prostate cancer and who is going to die of prostate cancer. And that's a huge distinction. Here's another dilemma, the dilemma part 3. And this is, I think, what has been brought to the forefront of the discussion in the last year or two. Some men with prostate cancer who received treatment probably didn't need it. Okay, and that's a very important point. The dilemma part 4, linked to the dilemma part 3, is that prostate cancer treatment has side effects. I'm very transparent with my patients when they come in to see me and they have newly diagnosed prostate cancer. I tell them that there is one treatment that I can guarantee will not have side effects, and that is what's called watchful waiting or active surveillance, which means no treatment. Every other treatment for prostate cancer, surgery, radiation, hormones, cryosurgery, anything has a potential risk of side effects. Not everybody gets side effects, but the risks are real, they are significant, and they are there for every other treatment. If you go to a doctor's office and the doctor guarantees you that he or she can treat your prostate cancer without side effects, well, I would dig a little bit more deeply, because in my opinion, that is not factual. That's not factual, because every single treatment has a risk of side effects. And this is the core, I think, of the debate that's been going on the last year, and that's what those dilemmas that I just laid out to you have been leading up to. This is what has caused all of the brouhaha in the media that you may have heard over the last year. This was the screening recommendation statement that the United States Preventive Services Task Force came out with earlier this year for prostate cancer screening. And what this task force does is it's asked to weigh in on important matters of the public health from time to time. And of course, cancer screening is one of those. Cancer screening, I should say, is a service that medicine provides to detect cancers in folks who otherwise don't have symptoms from those cancers. So this goes back to what I was saying about men having prostate cancer and not knowing it. This goes back to what I was saying about men being able to detect prostate cancer in men years before it would ever become apparent. And the idea behind screening is that if we pick up a cancer before it becomes apparent, well, then we can save lives. Because sometimes, as with, say, pancreas cancer, by the time it's become apparent, yeah, it's too late. It's too late, really, to do anything particularly effective. And so that's the idea behind screening in general, that we can find a disease, identify it, diagnose it, and treat it more effectively before it ever becomes apparent to the doctor or the patient. So the United States Preventive Services Task Force collected all of the information on prostate cancer screening that had been done, since prostate cancer screening really was introduced in the early 1990s. And after running a lot of analyses, statistical and otherwise, they issued what's called a grade D recommendation. Now, it's important to note that this particular group had gotten together several years ago and issued a recommendation that basically said they couldn't favor it either one way or the other. They basically said there's not enough evidence for us to either recommend for PSA screening or recommend against PSA screening. This time was different. They gave it a grade D recommendation, which basically means that not only do they not recommend routine PSA screening, they think it does more harm than good. They think it does more harm than good. And that has caused us to have this national debate about the diagnosis of prostate cancer, about screening for prostate cancer, and I think ultimately leading into that, about treating prostate cancer. It's really opened up a dialogue, and honestly, I think an important dialogue. This is a group, I think, in my own opinion, has approached prostate cancer screening in a rather heavy-handed way. And they are known, and that's my own personal opinion, that's my disclaimer, they are, however, known for being controversial. You might recall that they came out with a statement regarding mammograms for breast cancer screening in women a few years ago that was also controversial, that caused a very great public outcry against the idea that we should limit screening of breast cancer in particular populations of women. And I think to a certain extent that's what's happened here. I think that there's been an outcry from patients, patient advocates, on behalf of prostate cancer screening. I think I can boil down two primary problems with the statement here. And again, these are my own personal interpretations of the statement. If you actually read through the statement, if you read through the text of it, these authors actually say that, well, actually, if you screen in younger men under the age of 65, you save lives. You reduce prostate cancer mortality, as we say. You identify effectively men with prostate cancer who are younger. You treat them effectively before that cancer can ever grow and spread and cause them problems. And I can tell you that in my practice, I see that. Every month, I see men in their 40s who have been diagnosed with prostate cancer, aggressive prostate cancer, and the only way that they were diagnosed was with PSA screening. Well, a young man who's in his mid to late 40s who has aggressive prostate cancer and is otherwise healthy, that is a cancer that is going to cause him problems. And that is a cancer that needs to be treated, and that is a cancer that would not have been detected without PSA screening. So I think that in that sense, this overarching statement about throwing out PSA screening altogether, throwing out the baby with the bathwater, I think is unjustified, especially because if you read the body of the report, they themselves say that in younger men it saves lives. It got really buried, though. It didn't make it out into the media, particularly. The second problem that I had with this particular group was that the panel didn't include doctors who routinely treat prostate cancer on a regular basis. They are preeminent scientists, every single one of them, but they represent different fields of medicine for the most part. And not one of them is, for example, a prostate cancer oncologist. Not one of them was a urologist. Not one of them is somebody who routinely treats prostate cancer. And so I think in that sense, when you start looking at a lot of numbers on a page, after a while you start looking at statistics in a PowerPoint presentation, I think you start to lose sight of the patient who's sitting across the room from you. And I think you have to be very, very careful about that. Again, this is my own personal opinion, but this has been my interpretation of the report. So moving on from that report, a question that I often get from other doctors and from patients is, well, what are the official recommendations? You know, what's the bottom line, doctor? What are we supposed to do? And I can tell you there are no official recommendations. You know, the United States Preventive Services Task Force is just simply one body out there that makes what's called an evidence-based recommendation, but there's no overarching dogma regarding this particular topic. Well, what do other organizations say? Well, other organizations, I think, say something very reasonable. They say you have to individualize the decision. They say you have to do your research. They say you have to have a conversation with your doctor. They say you have to think about whether or not you need prostate cancer screening and whether or not you should proceed with it. And these organizations, I think, are very reasonable in these statements, and I think that they emphasize the individuality of each patient. And these organizations include the American Cancer Society and my organization, the American Urological Association. And one of the things that I can tell you that my organization has been concerned about with the United States Preventive Services Task Force recommendation is that suddenly that's going to change the calculus for insurance companies. You know, they're going to start backing away from reimbursing these kinds of tests. And that's worrisome. Again, because I get that 45-year-old man who walks into my office who's got aggressive prostate cancer. And so we've been my organization has been very public in its opposition to these statements by the USPSTF. And I think it comes back to this idea that you really have to think of each patient individually. Well, what do I recommend? Because that's what people always ask me, and I think it's only fair that I tell you what I tell my patients, what I tell other doctors, even when I tell friends and family members. I do believe in the idea that you have to individualize and talk to your doctor. Not every man's different. I'm 42 years old. I put my money where my mouth is, and I believe you should start PSA screening at the age of 40, and that's what I've started to do. However, if you're 80 years old, and I'll get to that. If you're 80 years old, I don't think you should get PSA screening routinely. If you're 80 years old and you have had normal PSAs prior, you're done. You should not be getting PSA screening. Because PSA screening at that point, I think, potentially does cause more harm than good. So I do think you need to individualize. I do think you need to begin at the age of 40 years, particularly if you have a history of prostate cancer in your family. If you have an uncle, a father, a brother, cousins, first cousins, I think that that's extremely important. If you're an African-American gentleman, I think it's extremely important that you begin at the age of 40 years. I think you need to check every 1 to 2 years. A lot of recommendations say annually. Annually is fine, but I think also if you get it, if you have a series of normal PSAs once a year, it's okay to back off and get it every 2 years. That's absolutely fine. And again, I think you should stop screening at age 75 years. I will sometimes see a gentleman who's referred to me who's 85. I think I've seen one gentleman who's 90 years old. And don't get me wrong, that gentleman was in excellent health. But his PSA really wasn't that high, especially because PSA, I should mention, goes up with age anyway. So every man's PSA goes up as they get older. So a normal PSA for an 80-year-old is higher than a normal PSA for a 40-year-old. And I just do believe that once you get to a certain point, then you don't need to go looking for that cancer, because even if there is a cancer there, it is not going to grow and spread during that man's lifetime if he is older. Well, what else do I recommend? What happens if you do have a high PSA level, let's say you go to your internist and you get the PSA test done, and it's a little bit high, and your internist says, you know what, I really think you should go see your urologist. Well, I think if you go to see your urologist, you really need to have a conversation about whether or not you really need a biopsy. I am very judicious about who I offer biopsies to. And there are a lot of factors that I take into account. Folks ask me what PSA level I recommend as being abnormal. I used to have a whole bunch of slides related to that. I used to say, oh, well, if your PSA level's above 4, you need a biopsy. Well, if you're younger and your PSA level's above 2.5, you need a biopsy. Well, in point of fact, I think it's a lot more nuanced than that. And I think that there are a lot of other factors that you need to take into account other than the absolute number. For example, the age, whether or not it runs in the family, what's the prostate examination like. And there's a very nice calculator that's been put together by a group of scientists who worked on something called the Prostate Cancer Prevention Trial. And this calculator, which is online, is something that I use every day when I'm in clinic and I'm counseling men about whether or not they need to get a biopsy. And I can calculate their exact percent risk of having prostate cancer detectable on a biopsy right there in the office, taking into account all these factors. And in determining that risk, I think about that other statistic I told you about earlier, where 25% of men over the age of 55 years of age in the United States are walking around with prostate cancer. I think, like, well, if 25% is the number of men who are walking around out there anyway, we have to sort of use that as our standard off of which whether or not a man should get a prostate biopsy. And so I have these very detailed conversations with men about whether or not they really need a biopsy. And, for example, an option maybe if you have a PSA level that your doctor is a little bit worried about, that you're a little bit worried about, that maybe even your urologist is a little bit worried about, one of your options before you do a biopsy is to say, you know what, I'll come back in 3 months and get another PSA level. Because the thing about PSA is that it becomes a more powerful tool over time. So a single PSA level is kind of like a single blood pressure level. It's not all that informative. But if you get a series of PSA levels over months and even years, that tells you a better story. And it can be a better indicator of whether or not a prostate cancer is there. Because, for example, if a PSA level is increasing very quickly, well, that's worrisome. But if a PSA level is just kind of staying level, isn't going anywhere, isn't rising, well, that's a PSA that's not as worrisome. So it all comes back to the fact that you really need to have a conversation with your urologist. Ask your urologist, do I really need this biopsy and what are my alternatives? And I think in the context of that, we are coming out with new tests that enhance the performance of the PSA test. So one of the problems with the PSA test is something called specificity, which is what I alluded to earlier. And that's the idea that, okay, sure, prostate cancer makes PSA levels go up, but a lot of other things make PSA levels go up too. PSA3 is a recent test that I've started to use in my practice routinely that is a test that you do on urine, and that reduces some of the noise. Now, PSA3 is a little bit more specific for prostate cancer. So if a PSA3 level is abnormal, that's a little bit better an indication, particularly in men who already have a high PSA, that there might be a prostate cancer there, and it gives us a little bit more information about whether or not we need to do a biopsy. Plus, I can take that PSA3 level and plug it into that equation I was talking about before that's online. So it really, I think, informs decision-making. I think also you're going to be seeing more very, very efficient biomarkers coming out within the next couple of years. And then finally, what else do I recommend? And this gets back to the point that a lot of men are going to die with prostate cancer rather than of prostate cancer. I think one of the things that had already been happening in the treatment of prostate cancer in my field, but it's something that I think has taken on new urgency with the public debate that's gone on with the United States Preventive Services Task Force recommendations, is the idea of watchful waiting. And so if you are diagnosed with prostate cancer and you're an older gentleman, particularly if you're over the age of 70 or 75, and you have a less aggressive variation of the cancer, you want to have a conversation with your doctor about whether or not you're a good candidate for what's called watchful waiting or active surveillance. Now remember, watchful waiting, active surveillance is that one treatment that I can pretty much guarantee doesn't have side effects because it isn't a treatment. And what watchful waiting entails is in these men who are most often over the age of 70, but we also take men now as young as age 50, and we have a growing practice at UCSD of men who are involved in this. I think it started in the academic centers. It started at the universities. I think it's the universities that still do it the most often. And we're very proud of the fact that we offer this at UCSD along with our cutting-edge treatments like robotic surgery and radiation and cryosurgery. We're very proud because we do consider this to be a cutting treatment. We do consider ourselves to be on the forefront of prostate cancer treatment in approaching men with the watchful waiting. And other than the age, we look generally at men who have less aggressive cancers. And I'm not going into details today because that's not the focus of our talk, but we generally look for men who have less aggressive cancers. And the reason why is that if you qualify for a watchful waiting program, if you're a good candidate for a watchful waiting program, research pretty consistently shows that there's about a 50 to 60% chance that you're never going to need treatment over the course of your life, that you have avoided treatment and you have avoided treatment safely. Moreover, the other gentlemen, the 40 to 50% of men who do require treatment, the research is pretty conclusive in showing that it is perfectly safe for you to be on a period of watchful waiting before you get treatment. That is to say, if you delay treatment for some period of time on watchful waiting, as long as you're coming back to see your doctor, as long as you're getting regular PSAs, maybe repeat prostate biopsies, the kinds of things that we do in a watchful waiting program, as long as you do those things, there's no less chance of being cured of the cancer if you undergo treatment at some point later in the future. Okay, and that's a very important point. So I've gone over a lot of very complex issues and tried to boil them down to a lot of, or a small number of I think the most important points. These are resources that I can point you to that have more information about prostate cancer and also prostate cancer screening. And what I've deliberately done is to leave a lot of time for questions because frequently, at least in my past experience having given these lectures, we do have a lot of questions, and I'd be happy to answer those at this time. Thank you. Yes, sir. So the question is, the gentleman in the audience asks, his doctor at the VA has recommended a prostate biopsy. He has a PSA of 5 and he's 84 years old. Is this the San Diego VA right across the street? Okay, I need to talk to you afterwards because one of those doctors probably works for me. So I'm happy to have that conversation with you. Yes, sir. Yeah, so the gentleman asks, he has two questions. The first is he had a father who died at the age of 87 with prostate cancer, of aggressive prostate cancer, and asks about screening for himself. That is a case where I think it does play into the idea that if you have a history of prostate cancer in your family, particularly that kind of a history, you're healthy, you're under the age of 75, I would recommend that you do get screening. And that you go from there, depending on what the screening shows. The second question is what the role of Gleason score plays, or Gleason sum plays in treatment, or of directing treatment, whether it should be definitive treatment with, say, surgery or radiation, or watchful waiting, the active surveillance. And my answer would be a lot, if not just about everything. Gleason is the single most powerful predictor that we have in general when we're counseling men about prostate cancer treatment. And I didn't go into details about it tonight because I just didn't have a lot of time. I wanted to focus on just the general principles of screening. Gleason is a measure of how inherently aggressive a prostate cancer is. We call it grading. And grading applies to any kind of a cancer. And it's basically a measure of how mean-spirited a cancer is. If you look at it under a microscope, it's how unlike normal cells in the body it looks, how ugly it looks under a microscope. Just to make things confusing, we don't have Gleason grading in prostate cancer go from 1 to 10, nice clean scale. We have to go from 6 to 10. And 6 is not very aggressive. 10 is the most aggressive kind that you can have. The ideal patient for watchful waiting has a score of 6. Now, there are certain instances where we do allow men with scores of 7 into a watchful waiting program. They're usually older gentlemen over the age of 70, but we do make that kind of allowance. Gleason scores of 8 or above, that's an extremely aggressive cancer. It's the minority of patients that are diagnosed. In fact, the majority of patients are diagnosed with Gleason 6 cancers, which are not particularly aggressive, as I said. The Gleason 8, 9, and 10 cancers, those are aggressive and they need to be treated. And a lot of times they need to be treated not just with one kind of treatment, but with several. So, for example, patients who decide to undergo surgery who have a Gleason score of 8 or 9, frequently they'll also require radiation. Or if they decide to have radiation, they'll also require hormone shots. So it's a very important indicator. Yes, sir. The question is the importance of counseling of children in whom there is a parental or grandparent history of prostate cancer on both sides, maternal and paternal. The paternal is the stronger link in general, but the fact that it's on both sides is important, and it's important that in those patients or in those individuals who have that history, that they know about that history, they report it to their doctor, and they consider that they consider themselves to be at a higher risk, not only of just getting prostate cancer, but of getting more aggressive kinds of prostate cancer. Because familial prostate cancer that's passed through genes, tends to be a little bit more aggressive in general than other kinds of prostate cancer. So that is a situation that you're describing where I would recommend that those gentlemen engage in regular prostate cancer screening, at least up until the age of 75. You're welcome. Yes, sir. This gentleman was an administrator involved in early funding for research of PSA testing and was relating his own experiences now at the age of 90 and his outlook on PSA. Thank you very much. Yes, sir.
If a doctor can feel a lump or a bump or something during the digital exam, does it mean you're pretty far gone?
Not necessarily, no. That's a really good question. There are gradations to that. It can be a very small lump, and if that is a prostate cancer, that's not particularly worrisome or troubling. We always, of course, like it better if it's such a small cancer that we can't feel it. But there are instances where we do an examination and it is markedly abnormal, and that is a worrisome situation. Typically, in those situations, we also know by the PSA level that there's something about the cancer that makes it more aggressive. Usually, the PSA level is quite high. And by high, that is a patient who is going to have a PSA level of 15 or 20 or 30 or 40, which, as you might know, is really quite high. And usually, in that situation, indicative of an aggressive cancer. Yes, sir. The question was, is there a relationship between benign enlargement of the prostate leading into prostate cancer? And my response is a qualified no, and it's a qualified no because while we have never found definitive evidence of that, there's been some really interesting research that suggests that while benign enlargement doesn't lead into prostate cancer necessarily, they tend to grow next to each other. So meaning that they represent two pathways of abnormal growth that happen to occur next to each other in the same prostate. But realistically, when I talk to patients about it and counsel patients, for example, who come in with benign enlargement of the prostate, there is no definitive research to show that a man who walks into my office with benign enlargement of the prostate is at an increased risk of developing prostate cancer. Yes, sir. The question is, if you have an elevated PSA, you get a prostate biopsy, what are the chances that there's a cancer there that you missed? And that's a very good question. I can't quantify my response to that. I can't tell you there's a 50% chance we're going to miss that cancer. Because, of course, it depends on the situation. I think the general answer I can give you is that is something that we are very excited about because recently our imaging of prostate has gotten a lot better. It used to be that we really couldn't see prostate cancers at all with any kind of imaging, even ultrasound. And lately, ultrasound is okay, but it's usually in cancers that are pretty far along that we already know are there. MRI, I think, is going to be the test that really holds hope for us to be able to look, image a cancer, and to be able to selectively biopsy it. Because for a lot of other specialties, like, for example, breast cancer, you're able to image the suspected area of cancer and put a needle directly into that area, very specific. Prostate hasn't been so much like that. Prostate, we routinely will take 12 samples of the prostate in the area that, statistically speaking, is most likely to hold cancer. That's a little bit inelegant. And it's been inelegant because we haven't had choice, because we just haven't been able to image it particularly well. But I think that's starting to change. And we're very excited about that here at UCSD, for example, because we have some great partners in radiology that are working with us to better guide and develop these biopsies. Yes, sir. The question is about the 12 needles, 12 biopsies going into the prostate, and whether or not that can increase the risk of cancer. And the gentleman specifically asks about the capsule that surrounds the prostate. The first part of my response is that actually the capsule that surrounds the prostate is not a true capsule. I did my research training actually with a pathologist who specialized in prostate, and the pathologists will tell you that there's it's not a true a capsule being sort of a fibrous, tough sheath around an organ in the body that protects it and keeps things out and keeps things in, and other organs have these capsules. The prostate's capsule, we use that term loosely, it's not a true capsule. It's kind of a point where prostate ends and then other things begin outside the prostate. The second part of my answer is that prostate cancer, unlike other cancers, some other cancers I should say, there's no risk of it spreading if you sample the prostate or you sample a cancer in the prostate. And this has been looked at in hundreds of thousands, if not millions of men, but there is no known increased risk of spreading that cancer in prostate biopsies. It's a very good question. It's a question that I get often. Well, so the gentleman asks, but if the cancer cells get outside the prostate and they migrate to the lymph nodes, isn't that a bad thing? You don't want it going to the lymph nodes. Well, I think that you point out something physiologically that makes complete sense, and you're absolutely right. You don't want cancer cells getting into the lymph nodes. But for prostate cancer, and specifically for prostate biopsies, there is no evidence that that ever occurs. It's a great question.
Question?
Yes, sir. So the gentleman asks about if you are taking pills for prostate enlargement and they stop working, are there procedures that you can do once the pills stop working? And yes, there are. You mentioned the reaming procedure, I believe, and I've also had patients refer to it as the Roto-Rooter. And it's a procedure that involves cameras and was actually invented in the 1930s. That was when it first started. And yes, we still do that procedure routinely. We do it in instances, for example, where men in whom they're having significant problems with prostate enlargement and the medications are no longer working. I use an updated form of that procedure routinely that uses a laser. So the original form of the procedure, which is called a TURP, or a transurethral resection of the prostate, uses electrical energy, essentially. And I use instead laser energy to achieve that same end. The gentleman asks me, does it have to be repeated after so many years? What happens then? And my answer is, it depends. It depends on the specific situation. Typically, a procedure like that is going to have very good durability. In the TURP procedures, for example, we usually quote folks an 80 to 90% effective rate all the way out to 15 years. 15 years of durable response from that procedure. And incidentally, after you do the procedure, you don't have to take the medications anymore. That's the goal, at least, is that you would be medication-free for your prostate afterwards. The question is, what about catheters? Some men who have prostate enlargement need to catheterize themselves to drain their bladder. And my answer to that is actually, it depends. And it depends because when you have prostate enlargement like that, sometimes the bladder, which is a big muscle, can get stretched out and flabby and not work very well anymore, which means that even if you remove the blockage, so if you imagine the prostate is a foot and it's stepping on a garden hose, and the fluid going through the garden hose is getting stopped up, even if I take that foot off, even if I take the pressure away, the bladder can't squeeze anymore. And in that case, yes, a gentleman would still need to use a catheter. If the bladder can still squeeze, well, then in that case, that could be someone who could get a good response from the procedure. You're welcome. She asks about the online calculator that I referred to earlier. That's a great point. I'm going to add that to this slide. Thank you very much. It's an online calculator. If you Google search University of Texas prostate cancer risk calculator. So if you Google that phrase or some combination of that phrase, you should come up with it. And it's a very simple, easy to use calculator. The information that you're going to need for it is the age of the patient, whether or not the patient has a history of cancer, prostate cancer in the family, the PSA level, the race of the patient, and whether or not the patient has had a previous prostate biopsy. And then you can also add in additional information, as I was alluding to earlier, including whether or not a patient takes these medications like Proscar and Avodart. You can add in PCA3 results. You can add in percent-free PSA, which is another kind of PSA test you can get. You can add in body mass index. So there are a lot of variables that you can put into the equation. Yeah, yes, sir. A gentleman asked me to repeat that. It's the University of Texas Prostate Cancer Risk Calculator. I have a feeling once you put in University of Texas prostate, Google folks are so smart now, they're going to fill in the rest of the words for you, and you're going to be able to complete it.
Prostate risk what?
A calculator. Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. Oh, so the gentleman notes that a friend of his had the seed implants for prostate cancer, which are little radioactive pellets that are placed into the prostate in certain situations, and notes that his friend had treatment 15 years ago and has been doing well ever since. Well, that's great. That's terrific. It's a very effective treatment for particular types of cancer for particular men. Great. Well, thank you so much for your attention and your questions today. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.